Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Achtung! Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, the Second World War podcast for all your Second World War podcast history needs. James, you've been in New Orleans because you sent some video of you in. I mean, I assumed you'd gone there to talk about the Second World War, but you sent some video of you in a Big Easy watching some trumpeter whale.
Yeah, Kermit Ruffins. He was absolutely amazing. He was properly good.
That's a properly, you know,
it's a Big Easy thing to do, isn't it?
Well, but the trumpet, Kermit Ruffins. There you go. Of course, he plays a trumpet in New Orleans.
Of course, he does.
What else would he do with his time?
Of course, he wears a pork pie hat. He was amazing. You'd have been impressed with their drummer as well. Boy, he was something else.
Well, they're all absolutely shit hot. Those people, right? I just want to read you something.
Yeah, yeah.
22nd of June, 1941. Wake-up call at 02:30. It is arse cold and we have been molested by midges. But never mind, it's a Sunday and today it's showtime. 02:50, fire up and forward march. Lieutenant Scherner's platoon in front, then the boss and the heavy platoon and myself, the new boy and his rabble at the rear. From the Jura Forest, we advance against the Sakhalin position and the line at Berbiskio to the bridgehead at Gara. As soon as we leave the forest, all hell breaks loose. I can't see anything at all, but I can hear some of our guys open up. Eventually, I and my lot also reach the spot where nothing seems to be going forward anymore because a long anti-tank obstacle is halting the advance. A few bunkers are behind it, built from wood and sand, very solid work. The advancing infantry had been taken under fire from the bunkers, several wounded and two or three are killed with the result. The boss and a Panzer IV with Oberleutnant Leonhardt drive up to the wooden boxes and fire directly into the firing slits from a range of 5 metres and less. The fellows inside did not get out and kicked the bucket instead. They were Mongolians. That.
Wow.
So this is book, new book called Blood, Dust and Snow, by which are the diaries of Friedrich Sander, discovered, edited and translated by Robin Schaefer. And it's this guy. It's his diaries from 1938 to December 43.
And he's what happens to him?
Well, you're gonna have to read the book. It's incredible. and there he is in his T-38, in his little Czech tank, and it's got hundreds of photos that are from this guy's,
which is not impervious to a boy's anti-tank rifle.
Well, and so on, right? But it's got tons of photos that Sander himself took. It's a 35 actually in some of this. It's absolutely extraordinary. And there are his own photos of the Russian steppe, pictures of how exhausted everyone looks, smashed up stuff, smashed up Russian stuff, and a great deal of
they all took photos.
But this is tremendous.
Can you see that?
I mean, this is it's an incredible book.
Fascinating.
Really fascinating. And
he looks quite mean on the front, I'm not going to lie.
Look at this stuff.
Yeah.
But what's interesting...
I mean, look at his photo on the front, though. He looks the part.
Yeah. But basically, what happens is he becomes increasingly disillusioned with the whole thing. I think.
Where did Rob find it? Then
I'm not sure. I don't know how he got hold of it. But it's fascinating, and it's. And he's wounded in the advance to Stalingrad by anti-tank fire, and then there's all this stuff about being in the hospital which is horrendous. I absolutely have to get back to Germany. I can't cope with being here anymore. It's really the stuff in the hospital is absolutely horrendous. And then his diary stops in 43, but it's really great. And reading it, made me think of, you know, all those chats we had about David Stahl's view of Stalingrad, you know, too much winning and all that sort of stuff. And that you've got a guy who's like a guy who's experiencing all that. It's
which Panzer group's he in then?
God, I can't remember off the top of my head.
That's four of them. It's got to be to four.
He's in 6th Panzer Division.
6th Panzer Division. I can't remember what group that was in.
Yeah. So he goes up to Ostrov, then up to Leningrad, and then they're redeployed and they're sent down to Vitebsk, over to Vyazma, and on to Moscow.
Okay.
So he does all of that.
He gets around a little bit.
He gets around a little
bit. Well, this is the whole problem, of course, was all these panzer groups are constantly being moved because Hitler kept changing his mind. Like saying, I want you to go to the south, and I want you to go to the north, and I want you to go to the centre, and then, you know, involves a massive deployment again.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's absolutely a nightmare.
It's fascinating. And you know, when you get to the winter of 41, what you get is the Russian artillery starts sort of getting better and more difficult to deal with, and you know their luck starts to run out. Anyway, I recommend it. I've read all of it.
Don't know what happens then.
I've read a fair chunk of it. Well, I did my usual
part of Army Group Centre, so that means it must be in either two or
I picked some dates I wanted to read. I went to the end, which is what I always do with books. So look
do you always read the end?
Yeah, exactly.
But you're not going to reveal what happens.
No, I'm not going to. Not going to. I mean, the spoiler is the Germans lose the Second World War, if that's what people are worried about.
Well, I've just had a whole.
So, what have you been up
years,
to?
Years ago, when I was doing Italy Sorrow, I found this incredible memoir by Hans Golder, who is the 7th Battery Commander in Werfer Regiment 71.
Right.
Which much of the time is attached to the 15th Panzer Grenadier Division.
Okay.
And he's an incredibly... It's impossible not to like him. He's a tough old professional, but he's also sentimental as well.
Yep.
And, you know, he's a proud German patriot, definitely, but he sees the beauty in life and he gets very sort of... very carried away with things and he says it as it was, and I've got the first part of his memoir back a couple of days ago, and I've been rereading it, which covers all the Salerno bit and Volturno and the Winter Line and Cassino, and he's in all those places. So he's, you know, part of the Salerno counterattack effort there near Capua on the Volturno.
Yeah.
Then he's on the Winter Line. He's in the Mignano Gap. So he's got Monte Samucro on one side and Monte Rotonda on the other and Monte Camino and all that. You know, so all these places are incredibly familiar. And it's just incredible. The descriptions, and some of it is funny. Some of it is really moving. Some of it is just disgusting, frankly. You know, people's heads being blown off and finding a fighter pilot in bits, and they recover a bit of his shoulder and, you know, all sorts of. I mean, you know, it's really, really unsparing. And I've got to say, you know, when you're kind of sort of, if the overall theme on this was just an absolute
horror show,
which, you know, it's certainly grist to the mill. It's just extraordinary. But I do think it's interesting. You know, we do always tend to, because they're on the side of the Nazis and because they're wearing swastikas on their uniforms and all the rest of it, we do always tend to kind of sort of lump them together a little bit. And obviously, you know, Waitman Bourne's got very strong views about this and thinks they were all culpable and all the rest of it. But, you know, they are still human beings and whether they're despicable or whether they're not, they've got feelings. They have relationships with their comrades. You know, there are sentiments. There are and it's hard not to. You know, you read them and you see them as real people. Just as much as you do a Tommy or a, you know, an American.
But then that also necessarily raises the question of what is culpability? Would I be culpable? You know, ordinary nice people are capable of appalling things as well. You know that. Where do these lines all fall in the choices you make and all that sort of stuff? And I think because I mean, Sanders, including these photos, there is a snapshot of people on the gallows, you know, people who've been partisans who've been hanged. Partisans could be absolutely be anybody on the Eastern Front. It could be anyone that they decide to string up. And that's in his little book of snaps. So yep. Next, and what's quite clever in this is it's next to a picture of a family he's been billeted with, you know, and it's a happy pic. They're all smiling together. This Russians who must feel they, or Ukrainians or whoever, Belarusians or who think feel they've been liberated from Stalin. So,
well, yes, and there's a bit which I'm a bit befuddled by, to be honest. So the Salerno battle is over. So, you know, whatever that is, 17th of September, 1943. He's then pulled back with his unit, and they're in the mouth of the Garigliano, which is you know, down on the Tyrrhenian coast. It's where 10 Corps then later attacks in early January. You know, the British get across and make that little bridgehead near Castelforte, which is one of the places of the amazing museum that I visited a few weeks ago. And he's down there, and suddenly they get attacked by a bunch of Italians from behind them. And he says, you know, we had to get those bastards and you know, we show them what for, and you know, weren't having any of that. People have turned coats and all this kind of, you know, it's all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I can't work out whether it's a proper kind of military unit or whether they're partisans or who it is. But anyway, they are attacked by Italians from behind, and they give them what for.
Right.
But that's again, you know, then the next minute he's billeted with some Italians, and it's all full of sort of cheer and laughs. And
yes, but you know, I've read enough stuff about British soldiers turning up on German civilians in the, you know, recently, and the families basically having to put on a show and be jolly and, you know, because what would I do if a load of soldiers turned up and decided they were going to stay in my house? I expect I'd welcome them with open arms. See, of course you can eat everything in the larder. Yeah, absolutely.
And
no,
I've got
problem.
A brilliantly stocked cellar.
Yeah, crack on. You know, I mean, what else do you do? You know, and again, comes back to what we were just talking about, the choices people make, the ordinary people make under this kind of colossal pressure as much as anything else. I mean, the getting these personal accounts and putting flesh on the bones of the people is really important, isn't it? It's because
I think so. Yeah.
Because otherwise it can be arrows on maps and ideas of sort of, you know, factories defeating factories and all that, which I think which is important to understand, but you've also got to think about the software amidst the hardware of war, you know, and the people being the software, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And it's interesting because the reason I've been in New Orleans is because that is where the National World War II Museum is in the United States. And they're the people that sort of keep the flame going very much so for World War II in the US. And they have this, what they call a conference. It's not really a conference. It's what I would call a festival, but they call it a conference. And they get... and what is really nice is they sell a set number of tickets. It's only about 400 or something, right? And you have all these sessions, and everyone sits at a desk, and there's a notepad if you want to make notes.
Really?
Yeah. And they have very, very few standalone talks, so they're nearly all discussions,
right?
And panels, yeah. But it's really nice because you hook up with old friends. So I've been hanging out with Pierre Samuel, who you remember we had on the podcast ages ago. I mean, ages ago, talking about France and Normandy and the reaction to France and all the rest of it. Yes. So he was there. Saul David, friend of the show, was there. So it was great to have him. Ben McIntyre, kind of hanging out with Ben a lot. I mean, he was just hilarious about all the SAS.
So he's been having fun, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's been having great fun. And you know, they absolutely are doing the second series, and the plan is to do at least four, as long as it goes well. So, you know, frankly, bring it on.
Wow.
But the other person I met, and actually I did kind of pod with him and with Saul together, was Henry Sledge. So Henry's father is Eugene Sledge, Sledgehammer, as in with the old breed. You know, one of the great classic memoirs. I mean, it's right up there, isn't it? Yeah. We've called it Safe Out Here and, you know, The Big Show and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a bit. So we've had an awful lot of conversation over the weekend about people and the experience of war and the legacy of war and what it does to you and what it was like for him growing up with this guy who's just had this horrific experience.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, fighting on Peleliu and then Okinawa. I mean, they're two of the worst land battles you could possibly have had the misfortune to be involved with.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you get married and you have kids and you get on with your life and you become a professor of biology at some Auburn University or wherever it was. He was an academic. And you just crack on with life. And it was just so interesting, particularly because, you know, we've been talking about demobbed and all the rest of it. So it kind of sort of really chimed with all that.
Yeah.
But then they also had to, you know, there were some amazing veterans there as well.
Really?
And one of them was a lady called Nicole, I think she's called Spangenberg.
Right.
And she was in the French Resistance, age 16.
Wow.
And she was telling the story about how they were, where were they, in a mountain somewhere in the, she was down in sort of Provence, near Caen. That was her kind of neck of the woods, almost. Yeah, I think she was Cannes. But anyway, so she was telling the story and there was this Polish resistance fighter and he got wounded in the leg and it was that, and it's, you know, so they had to carry him on, they put him on a mule and they led him up into the mountains to try and sort of save him, and obviously, you know, it's hot and the leg got bad and stuff, so they had to chop it off.
Fuck. I mean, goodness.
Yes.
God.
So she said we all had to hold him down. Oh. And we gave him lots and lots of Calvados. She said, "You've all heard of Calvados." We all went, "Yes, you know."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And they said, and then they removed his leg.
Bloody hell!
She said, "I have to say, it's one of the most. It's one of the things in my life that sort of stuck with me more than any other kind of thing." Age 16 at a mountain with a pole, his legs about. You know, he's after, and then we said, "Well, what happened to him? Did he survive?" And he went, "No."
Oh no.
She was just fabulous. Anyway, she realised, she after the war, she'd never heard of Christina Scarbeck.
Right, yeah.
You know, who we were talking to Claire Mully about.
Yes, yeah.
But then learned about her, so read up on her life and everything, and she realised that they were in that there was a day when they were in the same place on the mountain together.
Amazing.
But they must have been. But she just, you know, she can't remember her, doesn't... I'm seeing it, but they had to have been in the same place.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. And then I bumped into, you know, I was just about to leave yesterday morning, and I got into the lift.
Yeah,
and there's Lucky Luckadoo. He's one of the legends of the Hunter of Bomb Group from Thorpe Abbotts. You know about which Masters of the Air is.
Yeah,
etc. etc. And anyway, he said, "Oh, you know, you heading back?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Where have you got to go to?" And I said, "Well, I'm back to England." And he said, "Oh, whereabouts?" And I said, "Well, you know, down in Salisbury Way." And he said, "Oh, yeah, I was in England in the war. I was at a place called Thorpe Abbotts. Have you ever heard of it?" And I said, "Yes, I have. I've crawled all around the kind of, you know, the overgrown concert huts and all the rest of it." And he said, "Oh, yeah, there. I was there in the war." I said, "Yeah, I know you were." That's exactly who he was. 100 years old.
Wow.
He was properly good, though. I mean, he was still... And then I spoke to Ken Beckman, who had been a navigator and done 48 missions. So he did seven or so with his crew.
Yeah.
And then the lead navigator got... You know, they got... Ship went down.
Yeah.
So he had to step up on the mission. And he did such a good job. They said, "Well, you can stay." So then he just stayed, and he ended up being the youngest major in the 8th Air Force by the early part of 1944. He was there the whole of that. You know, he arrived in October 1943, so absolutely the single most worst moment of all through Big Week.
What?
And so the only reason he did 48 missions, not 50, was because the war ended.
Right. Okay.
By the time he got to that point. But you know, and I recorded a session with him, so we'll get that out at some point. But he was just so delightful, and so completely on it, still.
Wow.
And he just had his 100th birthday the previous week.
So flying,
he just kept saying, "I was just so lucky." He said, "I've been lucky all my life."
So flying as lead navigators, did the Americans, because they're flying by day, you have a guy at the front who's navigating for the formation? Is that what they're doing? Because I know they hand over to the bombardier when they get to the target, don't they? Pilot hands over to the bombardier, and the bombardier essentially steers the commands the aircraft at that point. I mean, is that what they?
Well, I'll give you a sneak preview. So he told me this main story that he directed them. They were hitting an airfield in Holland, and the bombardier just released his bombs too early.
Right.
You know, he got them to the right place.
Yeah.
Ken Beckman had.
Yeah, yeah.
But the bombardier released them too early, and of course everyone falls on that. So the whole, you know. they pummeled some village or something, but they didn't hit an airfield at all. And a short while later, then later on the next tour he was on, he got completely shot up and he was, you know, two engines out and he wasn't going to, you know, the whole place was riddled with shrapnel and they weren't going to make it home. So they were looking around for an airfield and the airfield he landed on was the one they should have pulverized, but didn't.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, isn't it?
Fortunes of war right there.
Oh,
incredible.
God, he just kept saying, I've just been so lucky. I've been lucky all my life.
That's amazing.
So anyway, so he stayed in the Air Force, retired at 50. So he said, so I had 50 years, first part, you know, I retired at 50, and then the last 50 years I've been retired. I said, what? So he didn't do another job or anything? He said, no. He said, every day's a Saturday.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and check this out. He still teaches navigation.
Really?
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible.
Absolutely incredible.
So he's not totally retired if he's still teaching navigation. But I mean, he's doing what he wants.
He just does it for fun because he really likes it. He's really fascinated by navigation. It's like Frank Sadler. So it's been fascinating. But what were the panels about though?
What?
Well, so Saul did a panel with Henry Sledge about K Company of the 4th Marines or whatever it is. So that was really interesting. And he had and Henry had had his dad's pack.
Right.
You know, which has Sledge written on it. And, you know, it was just amazing because there's that, you know, the actual kind of palpable link.
Yeah.
You know, it's just incredible.
There's that amazing Sledge quote, isn't there? When he enrolls at university, the clerk at the registrar's office asks him what he'd learned in the Marine Corps. And he says, lady, there was a killing war. The Marine Corps taught me how to kill Japs and how to survive and try to survive. Now, if that don't fit into any academic course, I'm sorry. But some of us had to do the killing. And most of my buddies got killed or wounded. I mean, God.
Yeah,
but that encapsulates it, though, you know, that this coming home thing. How can anyone, when you get home, ever know what you've had to do?
You know. Well, Henry was absolutely brilliant, and I really hope he can come over to We Have Ways Fest next year because he's brilliant, and he's so interesting about the legacy of his dad and what it means to him and growing up with him and seeing him write that book.
Yeah.
And he only ever, and like all the best memoirs, he only wrote that book for himself and for his family. He wrote it as a cathartic thing to get it off his chest, to kind of unburden himself. And of course, it had absolutely the opposite effect because then everyone started writing to him.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone wanted a piece of it. And then, you know, then they're doing the Pacific and stuff. Actually, after, I think the Pacific was probably after he passed. But you know, he couldn't escape with it. But he was sort of at peace with that decision, I think.
Yeah.
Or that eventuality. But anyway, so there was that. And then I did one with Con Crane, who's at the U.S. Army War College, along with Mike Nyberg and Tammy Hospital and various others. And he's a really nice guy, and he's an expert on air war as well, actually. But we did one on military blunders, which was quite interesting.
Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk blunders.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Way of Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. We just got to the subject of blunders. And so it was like a full, how many on the panel? Yourself and just the two of you?
Yeah, and John Curatola, who's one of the kind of, you know, he's one of the in-house guys. So he was sort of chairing it and sort of letting Con and I just sort of riff. But we'd had a bit of chat beforehand so that it wasn't complete, total kind of free-for-all riff.
Well, so what qualifies as a blunder then?
That was the whole point. Because, I mean, so they asked me to go first. So I said, well, you know, where do you start? I mean, you know.
invading Poland.
Lots of Gucci Renya kind of getting a little bit carried away on the Marco Polo Bridge. You know, that didn't work out very well, did it?
And
and then you sort of go, you know, Hitler invading Poland on the 1st of September. You know, that didn't work out brilliantly either. And, you know, I sort of went through all the way up to the Haltorver and then realised I was still only in May 1940. but Colm was interesting because he said, and we'd all, you know, we'd obviously sort of primed all this beforehand. But he said, well, you know, what is a blunder? Because sometimes, you know, you can make a blunder and it's the right decision at the wrong time, or it's the wrong decision at the right time. Or, you know, it's on what are you judging it? And so we did quite a lot. We did a bit on Rommel and the, you know, on North Africa. We did, we talked about Admiral Spruance, you know, so his job, he's got his, you know, the main fleet, you know, he's overall fleet commander at the time in the Pacific. And his job when they're attacking the Marianas is to protect and support Saipan, you know, and not abandon the assault fleet, which is under Kelly Turner, and stick with them, But then Admiral Ozawa then comes out with his, you know, his Japanese fleet with his carriers and all the rest of it, and there is a massive opportunity for Task Force 58, which is Pete Mitcher, to, you know, slaughter them. And Spruance won't let them go.
Yeah.
And that's because the primary goal is to support Saipan. That's what they've got to do. And it doesn't matter that Ozawa's come up. And, of course, Ozawa then sends off his planes, but they can see them coming. And, you know, that's the Philippine turkey shoot where they just absolutely slaughter, you know, literally the whole lot. And they do sink two Japanese carriers, but there is this feeling that there is this missed opportunity. That
they could have done more.
They could have sunk all nine of them or six of them or whatever. Yeah. And it's a kind of the Nelson thing of saying, you know, I'm not happy with 11 ships taken or 15, you know, anything that would make me happy is if we got all of them. It's that kind of thing. And there's been this sort of, you know, fevered debate about it ever since. But
that's interesting because that's a sort of blunder of omission, isn't it? You know, that there are because I think people think of blunders as things where you attempt something, it doesn't come off. Whereas that's, you know, a blunder of not grabbing your moment, not seizing the opportunity. And the thing is, you could overlay the whole of the Second World War and find all sorts of things where people didn't pick a moment that with hindsight, you know, there's a whole slab of hindsight flying around in this, isn't there? It's completely.
But you know, someone like Jocko Clark, who's the he's one of the kind of sub Task Force 58 commanders. Yeah. You know, he's absolutely chomping at the bit because he's got all his, you know, his aviators all primed, his aircraft carrier, you know, good to go, you know, 25 knots. Let's go and do it, but he's not seeing any of the decisions that Spruance is seeing.
No,
and you know, Spruance says, "I never regretted it. I, you know, this was the primary goal was to support Saipan.
Yeah.
You know, this is what we had to do. And you know, you have to remember that the nearest base is 1,000 miles away.
Well, yes, I mean that's the thing, isn't it? Is that and also things have gone wrong when people have been deviated, haven't they? You know, you could completely see why he might make that decision or stick to his orders. I mean, all he's doing there is sticking to his orders.
Well, yes, and the truth of the matter is the Japanese are screwed anyway. So, you know, you don't need to make that decision right there and then. Yeah. What you need to do is make sure that the troops, you know, if you're a Marine on Saipan and you can see everyone offshore and then you suddenly word gets out that they've all buggered off.
Yeah.
How are you going to feel? Like, thanks a lot, guys.
And you also, if you've been, you know, you also know what the margin, the narrow margins are in fighting in the Pacific. If you consider Midway, where there's a 5-minute margin between success and disaster, maybe an entanglement you hadn't banked on is exactly the sort of thing you shouldn't take on, no matter the, you know, the damage you could do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Jocko Clark and William Harrell, who are the two kind of, you know, rear admirals, I think.
Yeah.
Of Task Force 58.1 and Task Force 58.4 or whatever it is. You know, these sort of bits of, I suppose having been Task Force 58 commander, it's like having an army and these are kind of like divisions, aren't they? I suppose that's how one would think of it. you know, they're just coming at it from a different perspective. Yeah. You know, they don't care about, you know, they do care about Marines, but they don't, you know, worrying about what Marines are feeling on Saipan is not their concern. All their concern is about getting after the Japanese and shooting them down. Mm. And the truth is, they shoot them all down anyway.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to happen one way or another. What other blunders came up?
So yeah, we did talk a lot about and then quite early on, we opened it up to questions and. Yeah. Someone started talking about Mark Clark. So I said, well.
Here we go.
And I then sort of launched into one. It was like, someone needs to press a stop button. if I'm brutally honest.
I have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, it was quite funny. And then we sort of got, and it sort of went all quite, it sort of went off and stuff. But it's very interesting. And then we were talking about the Strategic Air Campaign, which Conn thinks was a waste of time. You know, that he basically thinks it was not a good idea and not well done and not well managed and could have been done better and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's quite interesting. He's saying, you know, 1943 was an absolute disaster. You know, but decision to attack Berlin was by Harris was terrible. Organization of the Eighth was terrible.
Yeah.
So I was saying, you've got to remember all this stuff is quite new. I mean, you know, you've got to kind of learn on the job. You know, these are all kind of, you're acting out on principles that have been worked out in peacetime in the 1930s when you've got different equipment, different stuff. Yes, you've got to get up to speed. But in the case of the Mighty Eighth, they come over to England in the first part of 1942, and then literally all of them then shoot off to Tunisia, North Africa, to take part in Torch and all that. And it's not until the summer of 1943 that they're kind of there in any decent numbers. And they just haven't been tested against the Luftwaffe in the West.
Well, and also, you know, the Luftwaffe are changing and altering and coming up with new solutions as the thing rolls.
Well, yes,
post
Gomorrah.
Yeah, exactly. Because everything's the thing is everything's permanently in flux until you actually have had Big Week and effectively defeated the Luftwaffe in, you know, in strength, everything's in flux. And even then, the flak effort gets better and cleverer and subtler as the war goes on, doesn't it? So,
well, yes, and also, you know, say you've got a formation of, I don't know, 434 B-17s and B-24s. Mm. Okay, they're all flying over towards Schweinfurt in August 1943. In formation, you know, they're like a ship's convoy.
Yeah,
they're all together in a big box, sort of like an aerial box. Well, that's like 5,650 caliber machine guns.
Yeah,
so you can see why the theorists would think that's probably enough.
That'll fix it. Yeah, yeah.
you know, you're sort of expending millions of bullets every single time.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, and then they learn. And so, hence the whole panic about getting a fighter, a long-range fighter, to protect them. But that's not something you just click your fingers and it just happens. You know, that's a bit of a process, which is why you have that whole kind of crisis of 1943. But I don't know. I mean, you know, blaming them, calling that a blunder, that's just working it out the hard way, isn't it? It's not quite the same thing.
Well, I mean, you end up having to qualify it. Everything is a blunder until you start winning in that case, don't you? I mean, that's
my point. You know, I don't think it necessarily is.
Yeah.
You know, I think sort of, you know, big, bad strategic decision backed up by bad operational level stuff and dodgy tactics.
Yeah.
That's a blunder.
Yeah.
The Gazala line. That's a blunder.
That's a blunder. That's a blunder. Yeah.
Defending Malemi. Abandoning it. That's a blunder.
That's a blunder. Yeah.
But anyway, it was very funny because there were some very nice IC members there and people who were very keen on the podcast. Lots of people going, wait, where the hell's Al? You know, Al should be here. I want to see Al. So anyway, so there was lots of that. And I said, I'm sure he'd love to be. And,
I'd absolutely love to have been there. Yeah.
But. I've got a challenge coin for you with a Spitfire on from Barry.
Oh, lovely. Thanks, Barry.
And Barry also suggested that we go, there's some amazing airfield on the East Coast. Can't remember where it is. Is it in Georgia, I think, maybe? Mm. He sent me a piece of paper with all the information on it so I could look at it. He said we had to get ourselves over there and they've got all sorts of stuff that we could look at. So now I've got a challenge coin for you from Barry.
Yeah.
And Nice Andy, who was born in Scotland, moved over to the US, and then he came to the first We Have Ways.
Yeah.
It was nice catching up with him and seeing him. And oh, there were lots of people. And actually, Henry Sledge is a big listener.
Right,
just
really?
Loves it.
Yeah, fantastic. That's very nice to hear.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
So
that's very...
lots of people over there. So you know, it is reaching the United States. It has to be said.
Well, and soon, We Have Ways USA will be up. We trailed that this week, didn't we? There's talk.
Yes, it is. I think it's up on Friday, isn't it? Friday the 25th, day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Yeah,
And there was an amazing talk about as well about the experience of black American troops in the Second World War, and a really really interesting academic who's an academic at Dartmouth. It'd be great to get him on at some point. It was really really interesting. I mean, really interesting. So there were some great talks, and you know, and lovely to hang out with Saul and Ben McIntyre and everything. And he was just so interesting about the whole process of writing and all that and the. You know, we had a little thing. He said, "So, what do you really think about mincemeat? I mean, you know, did it make any difference?" So we had that conversation. Well, that was quite interesting. I gave him my 2p.
Well, we know what you. I mean, regular listeners will know what you think about mincemeat. That it didn't move the needle at all.
He was slightly, you know, he was inevitably sort of slightly questioning it, but also then sort of going, "Hey, well, okay, well, maybe." I said, "I have always slightly wondered." But he was great. It was lovely talking to him. He's such a nice guy. Anyway, he is definitely going to come to We Have Ways. He said he'd absolutely love to come, and I think he'll be so. I promise you, he did the final talk of the so the last night of the conference.
Yeah,
is a dinner in the Boeing Hall, which has sort of, you know, above you've got an Avenger and a P-51 and a B-17 and a Wildcat or Hellcat, and they're all hanging from you. makes you slightly nervous sitting directly underneath them. I've got to say, when the wires look incredibly thin to me, but anyway, but you have the dinner and then you know, before you get down to PUD, they have a guest speaker, and they can be quite mixed, it has to be said.
Yeah.
But Ben stood up and did his talk on Colditz, and it was absolutely, totally brilliant.
Oh, excellent.
He does it with just the lightest of touches. It was really, really funny as well. I mean, really, really funny in parts about what they all got up to and capturing what they had, this outbreak of wasps, or the Brits would capture all these wasps, managed to capture them and then tie little bits of, with thread, they'd tie wafer cigarette paper to the legs of the wasps.
Right.
Okay. With Deutschland kaputt written on it. And then they'd keep them all. But they actually parade 4 times a day. And then at one of the parades, they all release them all.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The idea was that they'd go all over outside of the castle. You know, they wasps can escape the castle. Really, really funny.
That's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And one of the first inmates was some American Air Force guy. He was a spy, and he was just saying he was like the worst spy ever. He looked just like Lord Melchett in Blackadder Goes Forth, but he was American. And this guy's the most hapless, useless spy ever. He was really got captured. I mean. But he was very good about the commandant. He was a very sort of learned man and a former school teacher and had taught at Cheltenham College before the war. So spoke fluent English and was very learned and knew absolutely what everyone was up to all the time.
Yeah.
But when people used to try and escape, you know, he'd then get them back and take photographs of them and persuade them to pose in their costumes.
Really?
And he'd also created a museum of stuff that he'd captured of people, you know, sort of
escaping
fake
stuff.
Costumes and escaping stuff and all the rest of it. There was this French woman who dressed up as a woman, a sort of middle-aged frumpy woman.
Yeah.
And managed to get out of the gates before was called back. Just by bad luck.
Yeah.
Someone saying, you know, hey, Fräulein, you know. And then realised that, you know, he had a sort of... You know, stubble.
Amazing.
Anyway, and then he persuaded her to dress up again and pose for his photos. So he unearthed this incredible archive of photographs. I think he was called Eggers or something like that.
Yeah.
The commandant had had, had, had kept. It was just, it was really funny. But anyway, I can promise you, anyone who comes to We Have Ways Fest next September,
yeah,
Ben's talk is going to be an absolute treat. I mean, it was he was really brilliant.
Really entertaining. Excellent. And I mean, he must be fairly buoyed by the success of Rogue Heroes, because I mean, it's based on his books.
Well, he was very interesting also about the archive, right? Which and I said, so where is it then? He went, I just can't tell you. So I'm not, you know, I'm absolutely 16. I can't tell you. There's tons and tons of stuff, and because the archive was never meant really to be seen. It's incredibly honest.
Yeah,
he said it's not for the cabinet to see or anyone else to see. Yeah. So, and this is the other thing. They've got a Walter Mitty file.
Have they?
They've got an entire Walter Mitty file of memoirs, diaries of people who claim to have been in the SS who never were.
God, that's fantastic,
isn't it? So we then
that
got
is
off on
so
a,
interesting.
So we are on a huge thing about Dennis Avey and people and various other people that he thought were sort of bullshit.
Fascinating.
Right. Really, really interesting. Anyway, I don't want to spill the beans.
Oh, it'd be great. The subject of Waltz is fascinating in itself.
Isn't it? But anyway, yes, the Waltz file, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, you've been having thoughts about what to do next after haven't you? I really like your two ideas.
Well, I've been wondering. Conversations with my editor, but one of the conversations we had to write was to do a book called Combat, which is essentially another series of snapshots of people, and you do PBI, you do destroyer on a destroyer, what it's like being a fighter pilot in a bomber, you do the first half of the war with those people, and then second half of the war when it's more involved, so ground attack, sappers, bridging, artillery, you know, as the more technical arms maybe come through, maybe that's how I'd kind of go
someone
about
in a flail.
Look at it, someone in a flail maybe, and then an intermission in the middle, which would be R&R, you know, how do you relax when you're doing all these terrible things, having to deal with this. And
I just think WNTL. I mean,
you need to find some cast it, and you need to find some sort of find the angle and find the, you know, because I think the thing with thinking about the infantry is that, you know, they're infantry mechanized supposedly in the Second World War, but they absolutely are not. And mechanized means driven up in a lorry before you have to walk 20 miles to wherever you're going. You know, it's
with boots, which are just frankly
exactly.
Rubbish.
And this whole thing of
I've still never got to the bottom of why the British boots were so bad.
Because it's cheap. Because they're cheap.
No, how can it be cheap when you've got liver soles with hobnails in? What's wrong with rubber?
Well, I don't know, because you're using.
No,
you need
I don't
the rubber.
Know either.
You need the rubber for something else. You need the rubber. It's always that, isn't it? You need the rubber for something else. And the British are thinking like that, aren't they? I think. Anyway, but that thing of, you know, walking asleep. So many accounts of people talking about, I never knew you could march asleep and all that. So there's kind of that. And I think so you definitely do the PBI in May of 1940, what it's like being an infantryman, you know, going up to the deal line and coming back. And then, you know, sort of nadir of the infantry experience, which nevertheless contains all the stuff that infantrymen have to do when it's going well, which is, you know, endless tabbing, staying awake, keeping your weapon clean, just the absolute, that stuff, that bare bone stuff of being an infantryman, which I think is very, very interesting. And in fact, when we went on our Arnhem trip, I can't remember which one of the chaps was talking about, how he'd been an infantryman, and he said it's all about being, you know, you how fit you have to be to do it. You know, and it's anyone over 30 just can't keep up. You have to be absolute, and the officers have to be as fit as the men, and then read and their some. Mail, and you know, and make sure their weapons are clean and all that stuff. So there's something in that. And then I just sort of think, then at the other end of the spectrum, then you've got people in submarines. You've got, you know,
your artillerymen and all that. Exhaustion of the PBI, but then, you know, the artillerymen is constantly loading stuff up. And
you're digging, you're creating position. You arrive, you dig a position, you create the position, you unpack the artillery, you know,
then you
the
pack
rounds,
it up again.
Then you pack it up again and you move on. And you'll be doing that as easily as much as you'll be doing what are called fires now, shoots. I mean, you know, it's the thing, Keith, that the garrison talked about is, you know, how absolutely exhausting the packing and unpacking of the ammo is, that you're, it's like manual labor as much as it's like anything else. But you know, long before you fire around, you've got to have the ammunition ready. And I think that's all really, really interesting, and the sort of physical side of it. And I think, you know, Italy would be a good place to look at that, because that is the story of artillery in Italy, is that, you know, you set up, you do a shoot, you move on, the roads are difficult. It's as much to do with being in train as it is with being in position too. So anyway, I'm thinking about that. And then the other idea, and you know, this is...
I think you should definitely do that, but you should definitely do it. The other one is,
you know, has the sort of tang of inevitability about it, which is that I write about the Battle of Arnhem, but what it would be, because the problem is, and it's interesting this, because when Anthony Beaver's book came out, there was a review that said, you know, the book becomes repetitious because the Thursday, Friday and Saturday of the battle in the Oosterbeek perimeter is repetitious. It's the same, essentially the same every day. They hang on, they're mortared in the morning, they put the fires out, there's some sort of escapades with tanks trying to come through, bold stands with anti-tank, you know, it's kind of similar every day. And all the books you ever read, all the accounts you ever read, we, you know, also loaded with hindsight because of the operation failing and everything. So I want to write about one day, and you write from midnight to midnight on the Tuesday.
You want to do the Tuesday, don't you?
You do the Tuesday, because the Tuesday's got everything in it. They're still at the bridge, but they know they're running out of time. They fail to push into the town.
So what is that? Is that the 19th?
It's the 19th, yeah.
Yeah.
The second lift has arrived. There's a supply lift and some of the poles arrive while Four Power are extricating themselves from when they get too far east, north of the railway line in the woods. And there's the calamitous bit where they evacuate across the landing zone as the gliders are coming in with the Polish stuff. Because the Polish weapons are dropped the wrong side of the, you know, different side of the river to the Polish parachutists, you know, all that is the plan. And I just sort of think that Tuesday, and you've also got, it starts with Urquhart lost. So
yes,
paralysis of indecision.
Yeah, you've got all that.
And so, but to write it in terms of the town, the bridge, the village, the woods, the general, and to title it like that, and end at midnight on the Tuesday night, who knows what morning will bring. That will be, and that's how you end the book.
It's a really, really good idea.
Because
it doesn't have to be some monster, great big campaign book either.
Yeah, well, because the thing is those, you know, when I came to writing Command, the question is, how do I write a book that isn't like other books I've read? You know, a book that would interest me, that would thrill me. And there's an amazing book about the Battle of Waterloo called The Battle by Alessandro Barbero, who's an Italian historian. And it's a page turner. It's an absolute thriller. And even though what happens at the end of the day at Waterloo, you know, and it's the 52nd Regiment of Foot, it's the Oxford Bucks who break the Imperial Guard, and you know that's a fact and undisputed. And everyone knows that it's the soldiers of Oxford who win the Battle of Waterloo. And anyone who disagrees with me, email the podcast and I won't read your email. But the point is, the thing with Arnhem is there's nothing to contribute with a book of, there were panzers there after all. There's nothing to contribute with a book that has that. Or meanwhile, you know, on the island,
back
blah,
of the bridge.
Blah, blah. But there is something about the cellar at midnight on the, you know, first thing on, you know, 1 minute past midnight on the Tuesday morning, the cellar with the two battalion commanders from 1 and 3 para, you know, candle lit, arguing, you know, deciding what to do with what.
But it's the experience of war, isn't it? That's what's interesting.
And what's left of their battalions? Who are they in touch with? What do they know? What do they know about what's, you know, and then what happened? What's going on at the bridge? And what do they know? And they, you know, the bridge by the Tuesday, they are able to call in artillery from the lodgement. You know, first Airborne Artillery Regiment are able to, with their 75 pack howitzers, are able to put some fire down on the bridge in support, which is really interesting. So there is a kind of joined up, there are sinews going on, but then you've also got the disaster of Four Power Brigade going through the woods. You've got, and then everyone deciding in the afternoon of the Tuesday to return to the perimeter. So you've, you know, the South Staff's bugging out and all sorts of stuff there. So you've got you've got basically all the elements of the battle as the story gets told, but just the one day. And you don't, and the book ends with who knows what the morning will bring. So if someone wants to find out, they're going to have to go and buy another book about the Battle of Arnhem and find out. You know what I mean? I don't want to end with...
I think it's a really good idea.
If only...
I think it works on every level. I really, really do. But I also really like the sound of combat. So I think what you need to do is you need to sign up for two books, not one. You just need to take a deep breath and just go for it.
Yes, well, if my editor is listening, they can enjoy... enjoy this.
I think it's a really good idea.
This hustle that's going on right
now. If it was me,
right,
I'd do Arnhem first, then I'd do combat.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, obviously, it would be a book with digression. So if there's a bit with a peer, you've got to talk about what that is. You know, you've got to explain that. You've got, and because there's a lift, you can talk about what's going on, how the gliders work, what that is, how that's been arrived at, and all that. So there's enough room for digression, but the idea is midnight to midnight. So you don't do, oh, the landings have gone spectacularly that Sunday afternoon. You know, they bombed the lunatic asylum. You don't do that. Because the truth is, it's been done,
I think there's a massive advantage of keeping it in the moment.
Yeah,
keeping it contemporary. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what I've been trying to do with. Obviously, I'm going to put some analysis in Casino, but what I'm trying to do is keep it.
Yeah,
is not read too many secondary sources. I want to read just accounts and primary sources of what's going on right there on that moment, how it is perceived then, and I think that's the advantage you can have of that because. Your guys you're writing about don't have that hindsight.
No.
Because it's just 24 hours or 12 hours or whatever.
No.
It's a really, really nice idea. And I think actually, so the other thing that Ben McIntyre said, every time you write, you want to have jeopardy.
Yeah.
You want jeopardy at every turn.
Yeah.
You've got to think about your narrative arc and you've got to think about jeopardy.
Yeah.
That's what people want. That's what makes something compelling. And you'll get that because although ultimately we know what happens, I mean, in the same way that in 24 out of 25 Bond films, you always know he's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, he's going to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you don't want to say...
But you're still on the edge of the seat saying, you know, gosh, I hope he doesn't get thrown out the window on the train or whatever.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, yes. I mean, the thing is, this is one of the old arguments around history. Are you writing to be read? Which is really, really important, isn't it? I mean, it's
that's 100% what I'm doing. I have to say,
yeah. But that remembering that, holding that, and bearing that in mind, is really important, isn't it?
I think those are really good ideas. It'd be interesting to see whether you get any feedback on that.
It's a lot of bloody work,
a couple of things
mate.
I've got to mention. We have ways of making you talk USA starting on Friday, 25th. Of November.
Yep.
I also want to remind people about Windsong, the Dunkirk little ship. So the website, if you want to help, is wellnessoverwaves.com. So it is wellnessoverwaves.com. And you haven't got much time to save it, folks.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be, if it's not ready by middle of December,
it's gone. Go to the scrapyard.
It's going to scrap me odd. It's a Dunkirk little ship. Can't let that happen. The other thing, as I'm doing a talk with my brother to raise money for some Alzheimer thing in Salisbury on the 9th of December from 6:30, if anyone's interested and anyone's in the neck of the woods.
Excellent.
But I think we're going to record it and put it out as a sort of extra podcast on...
Oh, brilliant.
Both channels, as a team. I think it's a nice thing to do, isn't it?
And it is.
And you know, raise a little bit of Alzheimer's charity money.
Brilliant. That's excellent.
And there's no point advertising the National Army Museum one because that's sold out.
It's sold out. Yeah.
But I think they live stream it, don't they?
I think so, yeah. I think that's happening. Hmm. I need to figure out what if we're going to talk about, Jim.
Yeah, well, it's a tough one, isn't it, talking about command?
It's hard to say at all.
Excellent.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this week's discursive episode. We will see you all again very soon. There's lots of great stuff on the Patreon still, with the Jocks is just drawing to its close, I believe. We've got lots of stuff in the can, haven't we? So there's lots to come.
We've got a lot of stuff in the can, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even more now after my weekend in New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. Including Kermit Muffin or whatever his name is.
Kermit Muffin. Yeah. He was amazing. I didn't really want to go. And Saul said, come on, you got to come. It's, you know, you're in New Orleans. I was like, oh, I'm really tired. And I went out and perked up, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Excellent. Right, we will see you all very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.